Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. We are about to have a conversation with Van Jones, who is the former special advisor at the Obama White House, who was forced out after the right-wing press attacked him. We'll talk a bit about that and more. His new book is called Rebuild the Dream, and he joins us here from D.C. We are in the studios here in Baltimore. And, Van, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Glad to be back.
So this has been quite a sojourn. The book I found really fascinating, so I can't wait to get into the heart of this book. And I think just for the audience to kind of wrestle for a moment with what happened to you at the White House and how you have remained kind of steadfast in terms of saying Barack Obama needs to be our president again, and how that sojourn worked for you.
Well, I mean, again, people they focus much more on that because that's what they remember, but it was almost 3 years ago. That I worked in the White House. I was there as a special advisor on green jobs and clean energy back when we had a lot of momentum to get those ideas done. Frankly, both political parties that run on the idea, John McCain and Obama, that climate change was real, it was caused by humans, cap and trade would be a good solution that would create jobs. I mean, that was the only thing they both agreed on during the campaign. So, you know, 3 years ago it was, you know, kind of a no-brainer that America was going to get out there, seize this opportunity to create the jobs. The White House needed somebody who understood the connection between the workforce development, job training, dimension of this, and clean energy. And at that time, I was one of probably three people in the country who could do that. And I had just written the definitive book, a bestseller, Green Collar Economy, is the name of the book. And so I went to the White House as an advisor for 6 months. Of course, in my earlier life, I've been a left-wing activist of the first order in the Bay Area, and I distinguished myself as a radical activist in the Bay Area, which is very hard to do, given the left-wing character of the Bay. And so, obviously the right wing does what it does, and they tried to make a big deal about it. I quit because I didn't feel like dragging the president through every, you know, colorful thing I'd ever said in my life, and it was very painful. But, you know, I went on with my life, and I've, you know, since built a national organization called RebuildTheDream.com. We are fighting to get economic opportunity again for Americans. We're fighting the ripoff of Americans when it comes to student loans and the ripoff of Americans when it comes to home mortgages and getting real traction. And so for me, that 6 months was a part of a journey for a lot of people on the left. That was the first time they ever heard of me and the last time they ever heard of me. So for them, you know, that's kind of, I'm kind of fixed in that moment. What I try to do with the book, I try to put that moment in context for the rest of my life for people who don't know about the work that I've done in the 20 years before I went to the White House, juvenile justice, green jobs, et cetera, Hurricane Katrina, all that. But I also, and I think this is more important, I also try to put the past couple of years of frustration and pain with the Tea Party, with Obama, with Occupy and all that, in a context. And the context is this. You know, social movements matter. You listen to these D.C. pundits. You read all these books about the Obama administration. You know, the only thing that matters to these people are the politicians and the pundits and the polls. But we, the people, don't count. And I think that that's ridiculous. This book takes social movements seriously. I make the argument that it was social movements that laid the groundwork for Obama to run and win, not Obama himself. I mean, you know, God bless him, but we the people mainstreamed opposition to the war. We the people mainstreamed the climate concerns. We the people mainstreamed the idea that, you know, even in the war on terror, you know, you shouldn't tear up the Constitution. All of that was done by social movements that we were all a part of, which let Obama run and win. And then once he's president, social movements challenge his presidency, whether it's the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street or the Keystone Pipeline fight from the environmentalists and young activists and Native Americans. And so the book takes social movements seriously. It takes we the people seriously, and it tries to give the reader a sense that, of course, we've got to reelect this president. We don't want a Tea Party president, but he will only be as good as our movement. The president will only be as strong on our issues as we are strong for our issues. And that's the main point of the book.
Well, no, one of the things in the book, in talking about that, is that you go through these seven mistakes. And the first, and this first mistake popped in my head because of what you just said. And you said the first mistake was, first big mistake, number one, you say, was that organizing for America was great for the president and the Democratic Party, but not for the movement. And,
right.
And I let's talk about that from in the context of what you're saying in terms of organizing. I mean, because in America, I'm trying to put my hands around when you wrote in this part of the book, these parts of your book, what is the movement? I mean, it seems to me, in some ways, it's really amorphous. I mean, you've got the Occupy people, you've got folks that fought around the Genesex, you've got, you know, and it's been kind of very disparate, not necessarily a bad thing, but it is. So what is this movement that you're talking about?
Sure. Well, I would argue, a pro-democracy current in American politics. It got bigger, louder, and more coherent when Bush was in office. You know, we all kind of had something common to focus on, whether it was the war or Guantanamo or Katrina or, you know, tax cuts for rich people. And it kind of gave a certain coherence to the progressives, however you want to define that, of all stripes and colors. And once Obama got into office, I think there was some confusion that set in. And as I talk about in the book, you know, this, by the way, the book is a bestseller now, so it's good to have two bestsellers in a row.
That's good, Rob.
I tell you what, the other thing that's good about Rebuild the Dream being a bestseller is that this book was done with Nation Books, which is Nation Magazine.
Yes.
And a progressive publisher. It wasn't done with a corporate publisher. And we were still able to get it onto that bestseller list. And that's pretty rare, and I'm proud of all the groups that helped with that. But the point that I want to make is that, you know, once Obama got into office, I think there was some confusion. And I think it's as simple as this. People thought that we had elected, you know, Martin Luther King. You know, we'd elected a social movement leader who was going to rally the people, who was going to challenge the status quo, who is going to be able to, you know, smash through a lot of the old barriers. And you're like, oh, geez, we've got a social movement leader, and he's in the White House, kind of a two-for-one. I think that was a huge mistake because, in fact, we've never had that in American history. Even LBJ, who, you know, despite his mistakes with the war, was the most liberal president when it came time to sign bills about civil rights, bills about anti-poverty. Even LBJ didn't lead the civil rights movement. I mean, you still had to have Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Jo Baker, Bayard Rustin, Dr. King, you know, out there protesting. You still had to have the crisis in Selma. You still had to have massive social movement upheaval protests to get him to do those things and to, frankly, give him the cover and the space, but also the push to do those things. Well, we were in this very strange situation where under Bush, we did have the right movement in the streets. People were marching for peace, and there are millions. People forget that. But we had the wrong president. He wouldn't listen. Then under Obama, we had the right president, arguably, but you had the wrong movement in the streets. It was a Tea Party for 2 years, doing all the big protests, all the big mobilization, dominating the discourse. And progressives, for the first time, even though we were in the middle of this economic catastrophe, even though we're in the middle of two wars, even though we're in the middle of an environmental catastrophe in terms of climate change, which may, you know, rob us of a 22nd century, you saw very little national protest from progressives. Most of us were just, you know, trying to be in line with the White House. I mean, I'm, you know, guilty of stuff. You know, I left a grassroots organizing job to go into the White House, and a lot of people didn't do it physically, but they did do it metaphorically. And so that, I think, was a mistake. Now, what we've got to be able to do is have a president who can be moved, not a George W. Bush, not a Romney, not a Tea Party puppet, but a president who can be moved. At the same time, you've got a positive movement that can do the moving. And so that's what I'm calling for in this book, and that's what I'm doing with my organization, RebuildTheDream.com. It takes both reelecting the president, but re-energizing an independent movement that can defend the president when he's right, but also push him when he's wrong. And not having both of those things at the same time is why we did not get the changes that we voted for in 2008.
But there seems to be a disconnect in some ways. I was thinking this throughout the book and about part of the disconnect in America and inside what we call the movement, whether it's Occupy or whether it's the unions or whatever we think the movement is, that a certain segment of progressives who take on this administration around the war or around what they see as kind of being too pro-Wall Street, that some of it fueling the Occupy movement, has become a movement that says that Obama is not the answer either, so we have to go somewhere else. And then there's the other part of the progressive movement that maybe even have those feelings, but they're built around unions and built around other organizations and people inside the Democratic Party who call themselves progressives that are supporting Obama and say we have to support the Democratic Party. But I think that part of it, you have this split, and there seems to be no cohesive organization. In other words, I mean, in the book you mentioned SNCC at some point. I'll talk about that later, which I found very interesting. But it was part of movements in the civil rights movement were part of kind of organized movements, even though they were decentralized, some of them, that you could call movements. Do you know what I'm saying? So, I mean,
yeah.
How does that Rebuild the Dream fit around that reality? Maybe you don't think it's the reality.
Well, I mean, you've pretty much nailed part of what our mission is. I think both of those camps are half right and half wrong. The Occupy-influenced folk are right that just relying on D.C. Democrats and Obama and the White House to get everything done is a recipe for disaster. But they're wrong that it doesn't matter who is in the White House. We went through that in late 1990s and 2000 where people were saying, and I found the argument persuasive at that point in my life, that I don't see a lot of difference, that people would say, between a George Bush and an Al Gore.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being a younger guy and saying, yeah, you know, they're all corporate puppets, blah, blah, blah. Well, I tell you what, if anybody believes that Al Gore would have done the same kind of reckless warmongering that a George Bush did, you never met Al Gore. I just think that we were wrong on that, those of us who were on the progressive left at that time. And I've tried to learn. I'm the kind of person, I like to learn. I don't like to just say the same thing over and over again and just be right with my friends. I like to actually learn. You'll notice between the two books, The Green Collar Economy, which was written 4 years ago, mm-hmm. and this book, you know, there's some changes in my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've hopefully learned a little bit, my view about it is this. Those people who say, you know, all we need to do is elect Obama and support Obama, you know, right or wrong, they're also wrong, because that is not how American politics works. LBJ didn't lead the civil rights movement. He had to be pushed by the civil rights movement. Sometimes it got, you know, uncomfortable. FDR didn't lead the labor movement during the New Deal period. Those strikes and all that pressure that, you know, forced him and also gave him the cover to do what he did required independent movements like Occupy. All the way back to Abraham Lincoln, he wasn't an abolitionist. The abolition movement pushed him. Nixon, you know, just to be bipartisan, Nixon certainly was not a big environmentalist.
Right.
But he signed into law the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and the EPA. Why? Because you can have a crappy president, but if you have a strong enough movement, you can still get things done. And so it really requires both. It's like which blade of the scissor do you need to cut this paper? You need both. You need both a president who's willing to be moved and a movement willing to do the moving. RebuildTheDream.com is really taking on the work of occupying that space that can really affirm both and try to coordinate so that we are doing what the Tea Party does, frankly. The Tea Party, they protest and vote. They get out there and rally, at least they used to, and march down the street and raise hell, and then they turn right around and they elect the candidates they want to elect, and they keep right on moving. We're the only force in American politics, the progressives, that are still doing eeny, meeny, miny, mo, pick one way of doing it and then, you know, despise the other blade of the scissor. Well, guess what? If you don't have that hinge point, you're not going to get anything done on either side.
So I agree. And you write a lot in the book about the Tea Party and that movement. And one of the things I was thinking as you were just speaking and also as I was reading the book was that whether it's the Fox News piece you talk about or what the Tea Party did and how you said that the progressives didn't respond in a certain way, which we can talk about, is that the Tea Party was like, in many ways, 30 years in coming. I mean, it was or maybe even more, built on the back of billions of dollars, literally hundreds of millions of dollars, I should say, paid by billionaires over years of building a very conservative right-wing think tank movement that helped fuel and build this Tea Party movement that kind of looked like a populist movement. In some senses, it was. But that's kind of why I could feel more cohesive. And so the question is, when you talk about Rebuild America, I'm curious about how you think that the progressive side, which is clearly half of America, if not more, gets to that place.
Well, Rebuild the Dream is the name of the organization,
right.
RebuildTheDream.com. And what I would say is, they had the same 30 years that we had. And, first of all, we have people say, well, it's almost like we're saying, well, they cheated,
Right.
it doesn't make sense to me.
Right.
We do have a lot of think tanks and those kinds of things on our side as well. I think that the brilliance of the Tea Party movement is that it did take a lot of pre-existing assets and resources, but it was able to align them and repurpose them to both tap a genuine populist movement and sentiment, but also to shape that populist sentiment in ways that would be very effective and useful in making real change from their point of view. If I had a magic wand, I would just say, we should just do the same thing. Well, progressives are a little bit less less willing to fall in line sometimes, famously. And yet, look at what has been happening. When Occupy Wall Street came out, if you had said a week earlier that a bunch of kids and struggling folks with sleeping bags would be able to change the national conversation with no focus group, no polls, no ads, no candidate, you'd have said no way. But once they set that poll, that inequality, economic inequality, was out of hand, that Wall Street was getting away with murder, that big money was buying our politics. Once they set that poll, you did see, not the occupiers themselves necessarily, but every other layer and circle around them began to act much more cohesively. Even the White House began talking in more economic populist terms. The labor movement and groups like MoveOn.org, my organization, and others came out and really amplified those themes and helped to really set them and cement them in the American consciousness. You can now say the 99% and the 1% on any sitcom in America, and there's an understanding. Now, the next steps, which we did not take as effectively, and the Tea Party did, they pivoted from protest to electoral politics. They went from protesting in the streets to voting in the ballot booth, and then had real power. Even when the protest died down, they still had real power. The occupiers are more interested, and they certainly have their right and their reason, are more interested in direct democracy and direct action, not so much electoral democracy. Well, that's good because you need those kinds of things, but it has left a hole. And RebuildTheDream.com and other groups are trying to fill the hole of the people who want to defend the 99% and stick up for the 100%, not just in the streets, as important as that is, but also additionally in the electoral process, in the halls of Congress, and to make sure that this mass sentiment out there now does get transformed into real power. And the book lays out a couple of roadmaps for that.
Yes.
And RebuildTheDream.com is focused on that every day.
So, again, let me take back to the thing about a couple of things that you wrote about in the book as well. That, I mean, when we talk about the Occupy movement, and I one of the things that in a paragraph there you talked about, you kind of likened it in some senses to SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee,
yeah,
which I appreciated, myself being a little older than you, Van, as an old SNCC worker myself, that I appreciated that. But and one of the things I thought, though, what the difference was, and maybe I'm wrong about the Occupy movement here, even though I've interviewed a lot of folks in that movement who occupied these squares around America, is that one of the things SNCC did, SNCC was out in the trenches of Mississippi, Maryland, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, organizing people on the ground in kind of a movement for freedom and resistance in a very dangerous territory. And so I mean, that one of the reasons it was successful, even though people were, even in the communities were afraid to align themselves with SNCC sometimes, was because of the hardcore organizing and getting that done. And sometimes that's the piece, I think, that we miss.
I think that's right, though there's a lot more of that happening with Occupy than gets put in the newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they get a lot of attention for their high-profile protest tactics. But they're, you know, depending on the city that you're in, very seasoned organizers who've been around for a very long time are deeply involved, and people are, you know, they're doing all kinds of things, community gardening, and all kinds of things are happening. And then also you have different affinity groups that maybe have gotten frustrated with the hyper-democracy aspect of Occupy, as they call it, and they have been moved over into their own working groups that may not even call themselves Occupy, but are doing great things. And so, I mean, what you have is a very dynamic movement. What I will say, though, you know, those of you who are in SNCC, you occupied the lunch counters, you occupied the segregated buses with the Freedom Ride, but you also helped Mississippians, as you say, occupy the voting booths. And I do think that it is very hard to make change in a country like ours if you aren't doing both the direct action and some of the smart electoral stuff. Now, not on the terms of the worst of the Democratic Party, but you can primary bad Democrats or bad Republicans for that matter, and you can elect out of your own ranks better candidates or pass ballot measures. I mean, there are all kinds of tools that are available, and I just don't think that given the level of the crisis, we should leave any tool on the toolbox. I mean, any peaceful, nonviolent tools from education to protest, agitation, voting, all these things should be on the table. And I think it hurts the movement when we divide up over tactics as opposed to coming together on a strategy to increase the power of 99% and to blunt the power of the worst of the 1% in every arena.
And let's talk a bit more about that. I mean, you have an incredibly interesting chapter here on Occupy the Inside Game. And we can, if you want, you can take a step backwards and describe your overall theory of Occupy the Inside Game and how that fits into your kind of paradigm of Occupy the Outside Game, Inside Game, and the headspace, and how you build a movement around those ideas. Why don't we stop and do that for a minute, and then I'll come back to my question about the inside game. I mean, describe that political dynamic that you wrote about.
Well, I think one of the things that's most useful I've been told about the book, I mean, there's certainly the prologue where I really talk about my own experience as an activist and winding up in the White House and leaving and the decision making behind that. People have found that to be very helpful.
Mm-hmm.
I understand and I encourage people to look at that. Another part of the book that people have found helpful is this grid that I've created in trying to do my analysis of, you know, what did happen with the Obama campaign. Why was the Tea Party effective? What is the good, bad, and otherwise around Occupy Wall Street? What are we supposed to be learning from these big social movements that seem to come out of nowhere? Well, to try to capture as much data as possible and make it useful, I created a grid that I share in the book, and it's called the Heart Space Headspace Grid.
Right.
And it just basically captures four quadrants, the heart space, the headspace, the inside game, and the outside game. And I just use those four modalities to capture and describe what people are up to. Those people who are part of your listenership, who are serious about politics, I think will find this tool very helpful. Because sometimes it really is about the policies, it's about the subcommittees, it's about the headspace and the inside game. It's about the math and the deal making. But a lot of times in politics, it's about the emotions. It's about whether the health care bill is, whatever's written on page 497, nobody knows. But is it being called socialism and death panel, or is it being called, getting doctors to babies? Like, that is a more of emotional framing. And then also the outside game, when ordinary people who may not know, who the chair of the relevant subcommittee is, but they're out there marching, they're putting up, posters in their yard, signs in their yard, they're putting bumper stickers on, they're talking to their neighbors. That dimension of politics can be very, very powerful and influential. And yet, often people just focus, especially liberals and, you know, the NPR crowd, which I'm a part of, and the New York Times crowd, we will focus way too much just on, you know, the smart idea and what's happening in Congress this morning, and forget that 310 million Americans are not following all that, but they do want real values spoken to. They do want to feel that somebody's on their side. They do want their pain to be acknowledged. And all that's in the domain of the heart space and the outside game, which I think the right wing has done a much better job of with Fox and with the Tea Party than we have.
And when I read that part of your book, it really struck me, because I think that, it tied back to things you wrote about in parts of the book about the media war against you and against others, and the media war that's waged by Fox and on the right. It's been very successful in many ways, and that it does hit the emotion, the kind of emotional, the viscera of our responses to things. And I thought that you were dead on in this whole idea that progressives need to start thinking that way and moving that way, and really kind of not becoming like a soundbite replica of the right, but understanding that if you don't touch the emotional core of people where they live, that movement will not succeed.
I think that's right, and I even write some, share some snippets of speeches and ads that could have been written. You know, the president had a great opportunity when he came under such withering fire for his health care proposal, and he was being called a socialist and a communist and all these different things, to step up to the plate and really answer those allegations and actually clarify, to use the fight. Liberals love to kind of stand above the fight. We don't want to get in the mud with people. Let's stick up here at the level of high principles. But it's a high principle to defend yourself mm-hmm. when and to defend your cause when it comes under unjust attack. And so, one of the things that I was talking to a healthcare organization a couple of days ago, and they were saying, what can we do? People keep, every part of our health care bill polls individually very well, letting young people stay on their mom's and dad's insurance policies until they're 27, given this job market and how long it takes to get a good education. Everybody thinks that's great. And you can take this health care bill apart, and each part of it will pull through the roof, and then you put it together, and everybody hates it. And they're just so baffled by it, so confused by it, so frustrated by it. And I said, well, hold on a second. When they called this thing death panels and socialism, and this and socialism in America just means some crazy foreign idea. They don't even necessarily know what that means. And I mean, we don't have those levels of the high level of debate you have in Latin America and Africa and Europe about this stuff, and even Asia. I said, it's basically called poison. And you don't defend it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you take, very good food, you put it on the plate, and the plate's called, labeled poison. Well, of course people don't want the plate. They may say, well, I want that apple. But they aren't going to want that plate. So we have to do a better job of, we know that our opponents are going to attack us. We know what they're going to say before they say it. I mean, it's not like they said something new since the McCarthy period. They're going to race bait. They're going to do all the stuff they do. And we have to actually learn and change. And one of the things I think hurts us, and one reason I wrote this book, Rebuild the Dream, is we have to learn and change. Part of where I think we've gone wrong, we have this stereotype that conservatives are stupid and that it's, these people are just dumb. And, if only they were a little bit better educated, then they would think like us. Well, that kind of hubris is itself dumb because, the people, half the country is not stupid. They have their own understanding and value set. And our failure to speak to them, then we're not going to get all of them. 33% of the country is always going to be on one side. 33% is always going to be on our side. It's those 33% in the middle who are persuadable, but who do find some of the concerns that the right wing raises to be credible. We have to speak to them. And the book really tries to lay out a way to talk about patriotism from a deeper point of view. We shouldn't let one side of the political spectrum own patriotism. That's a very bad mistake we have made over the years. Deep patriotism is simply a commitment to liberty and justice for all, which progressives can make a much stronger claim about most days of the week than anybody else. Liberty and justice for all. We the people. The idea of America the beautiful. Who is doing a better job of defending America's beauty from the oil spillers and the clear cutters and the mountaintop removers than progressive environmentalists? But we never talk about it as defending America's beauty. You can go down the line. The Statue of Liberty. Who is defending, you know, the rights of immigrants and sticking up for that poem at the base of the statue? Give me your tired. Give me your poor. Give me your huddled masses who yearn to live free, who yearn to breathe free. That is as American as America can get. That's the Statue of Liberty. Well, who's defending those ideas in America? It's a progressive. And yet we don't talk in those terms. And so we have to be as smart and as sophisticated as the system we are trying to change, which means that when we get out there with the way we like to talk, with, you know, 27 syllables in every word and all this, and people aren't resonating with us, you know, then we need to learn how to talk better. And we maybe need to be more open-minded, that maybe the part of the country that is not listening to us, we can learn from them, just like we wish they would try to learn from us.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. My guest this hour is Van Jones, former advisor to President Barack Obama. Van's the co-founder of Rebuild the Dream, the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, Color of Change, and Green for All. His new book is called Rebuild the Dream. And we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Van Jones. So don't go away. Welcome back to The Mark Steiner Show. My guest this hour is Van Jones, a leading progressive activist and thinker, former advisor to President Barack Obama, and author of his new book, Rebuild the Dream. Van's also the co-founder of Green for All, Color of Change, the Ella Baker Center for Human Rights, and Rebuild the Dream. Well, let's return to our conversation. You talk in the book, in terms of the mistakes and several other places, about Obama's administration's relationship to Wall Street, to the economy, to the best thing he did was to push the recovery early, and that was a huge plus for him. And you talk about that two different portions of the book, about that whole issue. And here we are now faced once again with James Dimon and J.P. Morgan. And there are a lot of people who are saying, and many Americans now are saying, that in the latest polls coming out this morning, that they don't think President Barack Obama did enough to take on Wall Street.
That's true.
In these swing states. And so talk about that in terms of this election, President Obama, and what you think has to be done next. Because in the swing states, this is at least becoming a key issue, with a lot of people saying that they're worried about this. And I'm curious what you, in toto, how you look at this in terms of the movement, President Barack Obama, and what happens next.
Well, you know, I can only speculate. This is not a part of my job description when I worked in the White House. And I don't talk, and I don't talk to people in the White House about this kind of stuff. But I can only speculate that there was probably, at least subconsciously working in somebody's mind somewhere, the idea that, you know, if you came down too hard on Wall Street, you might either hurt the economy or inflame political opposition to you know, heights that couldn't be handled from the financiers on Wall Street. And again, this is speculation, but I think those kinds of fears, hey, if you take on Wall Street, and does it wind up somehow boomeranging and making the economy worse? Do you make enemies that you're going to need to be able to work with? I think those kinds of considerations probably impacted the decision making. That said, I think it was a huge mistake, because had the administration come down on Wall Street, which frankly it just ruined the economy, and really made them pony up, pay for some of the damage, limit their bonuses, make some real commitment to reinvesting in the country, those kinds of things, and frankly putting some of them in jail. You know, Reagan in the SNL crisis put thousands of bankers in jail.
Right, right.
We haven't seen one perp walk in 3 years. This is a tremendous mistake on the part of the administration. I don't think anybody with a functioning brainstem could argue that enough has been done, or enough was done, or that was handled with the maximum best possible outcome for the American people. And so, and I think it turns out that it may be politically costly as well. It seems that the financiers on Wall Street are still just as mad at the White House as they would have been otherwise,
mm-hmm.
Even though none of them have gone to jail and they still are doing the same dumb stuff they've been doing. Just the fact that the president said a few things in speeches that they found to be offensive was enough to push them over into the camp of the opposition. Well, if they're going to be that delicate that a few words is going to have them writing big checks against you, well, then maybe a few of them going to jail would have been at least would have been a behavior changing move on the part of the administration, which would have been good for the country. And then maybe people in the swing states would have been more confident in the leadership from the administration on this point. But again, this is all beyond my area of expertise.
It is, but Van, and by the way, folks, we're here talking with Van Jones. His latest book is "Rebuild the Dream." But it is Van. But you know, when you write in the book, your big mistake number six is no Spanx for the banks, and that. But you come up in that chapter with some very clear ideas about what should have happened and could have happened.
Yeah.
So maybe it was not in your bailiwick, but you clearly are. I mean, this is something you see as fundamental to the emotional aspect, if not just the intellectual argument. It's part of the visceral emotional argument with most of America right now about what we're facing and what to do. And those things you outline are things that would grab people's gut.
Yeah.
And the question is, you know what I'm saying?
Sure. Well, I mean, I think that the regular person walking down the street, you know, the barbershop crowd, the laundromat crowd, you know, they probably have a sneaking suspicion that people on Wall Street get away with stuff they couldn't get away with, and that it probably has to do with their ability to buy access and rig the rules. And now that's not a left-wing, you know, thing or a right-wing thing. That's just, if you're an American, you don't mind winners and losers. This is not a European country where people really obsessively worry about, well, you know, what's going to happen to the losers. We don't mind winners and losers in America. In fact, every daggum show you watch,
right.
You know, is some reality TV show where people are competing. I mean, but we hate cheaters. We hate cheaters in America. We don't mind economic winners. We try to help the losers a little bit, but we don't worry about them that much. We figure in a fair game, the losers will learn and come back. But we hate cheaters. We hate people who rig the game. We hate people who buy the rules. We hate people who buy the refs. And that is why people are so upset with Wall Street on both sides. But the challenge is, if Democrats are afraid to be forthright in saying, guess what, everybody in America is going to play by a fair set of rules, including the rich and powerful, and without fear or favor, we're going to enforce the rules. And if Pookie and Snoopy and Shanae can go to jail for minor offenses, well then, you know, the Jamie Dimons of the world, you know, not him necessarily particular, but the people at that level, if they have done something wrong and that is criminally wrong, they will also go to jail. That is, you know, a position that people on the right and the left can respect. The problem is that, you know, you get too clever by half sometimes. In that Washington, D.C. atmosphere, and the deal-making kind of goes, you know, a bridge too far, and then ordinary people can't understand what's going on. They can't follow the plot, and they just get reinforced in their cynicism because they know that there's no way they could crash their company and still have a job, let alone crash the economy and have a job and a bonus.
Yeah, and you make that point vividly towards the end of your book, when you talk about why people like Steve Jobs and not Bernie Madoff,
right?
I think that and that's part of the key. You take a step backwards for a minute. You don't talk about this directly in the book a lot, but I've been thinking about it and had conversations with a few of our congressional representatives about this, and I'm curious as your take. in the United States Congress, within the Democratic Party, there is this Progressive Caucus.
Yes.
And there are also many other Democrats who are not in that Progressive Caucus, but really have a lot of the same kind of political, social views as people in the Progressive Caucus. In the Progressive Caucus, most of the Latino congressmen, African-American, many white congressmen are all in this caucus together. But my criticism of them has been, to them, is that what are you doing with your power? Why aren't you an organized force that raises money for candidates, that pushes people in local elections, that kind of it becomes a political force on its own? Because they seem like they might have a – they're like a name only. And maybe I might be unfair of them. I like to, but you run in that world more than I, and I'm curious what you think.
Well, they have been making improvements. This is called the Progressive Congressional Caucus, and CPC, Congressional Progressive Caucus. And they are making improvements. They it has taken a while, I think, for them to get on their feet, but they've made some good new hires. Frankly, they had good hires before. I think the need is there now. Luis Grijalva and Keith Ellison are the two congresspeople, one Latino, one African-American, who have become the new co-chairs.
Right.
And they have really begun to have meaningful meetings and planning sessions and to invite others in. And I just think it takes a while to figure out how to use the power that they have. Certainly, Luis Grijalva is under some fire now. He had some a gerrymandering attack on him that he's having to fend off. I think he'll survive it. But you're raising a very good question, and I really encourage people to read the book that I wrote, "Rebuild the Dream," because in the book we do get into the policies that could be passed that are very popular policies. 60%, 70%, 80% approval of these policies. And I encourage people to look at the book. We call it The Contract for the American Dream.
Right.
And that actually, the Congressional Progressive Caucus actually turned those 10 proposals, which you have to do with everything from saving Medicare and taking money from oil companies and, all the smart progressive things that could be done. The Congressional Progressive Caucus, which is the biggest caucus in the House, about 80 congresspeople, took that and turned it into an omnibus bill called the Rebuild the Dream for the 99% Act. And that, I hope, will become the cornerstone at the end of this year when the time comes to deal with the budget, because everybody's focused on November. But their big fight, just an equally big fight, is also in December. And in December, we've got to deal with the budget fight when the Bush tax cuts expire, et cetera. Well, we have a cornerstone piece of legislation that would be the basis of a real grand bargain that would really deal with the deficit without destroying the middle class and working class and poor folks in America. And so, these things do take a while to develop. You mentioned the 30 years that our opponents spent getting their house in order and getting prepared to act the way that they are acting. I am committed, and RebuildTheDream.com is committed, and the book I just wrote is about us getting our act together. We're now fighting for all the marbles. Our opponents only want one thing, everything. They want everything. They want to be able to use America, to have our military go fight wars for them. They want to be able to use our water and our air as a dumping ground for poison and pollution. They want to take a wrecking ball to the public school system, to the labor movement, to everything that made America great. They want to be able to knock that down, smash it down, flatten it out, suck all the value out of this country, suck all the money out of this country, and then give nothing back. They want to pay their taxes. They don't want to respect the air and water and our children's health. They don't want to create any jobs here. They want to create any factories here. They just want to suck this country dry and hand it over to global corporations who, through things like the super PACs and Citizens United, can buy our democracy and use it to further rig the rules for themselves. This is a fight for the middle class, the working class, for democracy, for all the gains of the last century. And our organization is not afraid to say that. The book's not afraid to say that, and not afraid to stand up for what made this country great. This country was not the envy of the world. It's still the envy of the world, but we didn't become the envy of the world by smashing down public education, smashing down unions, smashing down the safety net, paying no heed or care to the fact that the ladder of opportunity is falling over, and attacking women and being disrespectful toward people who are different. All of those values that these so-called patriots champion and espouse are the opposite of the values that made America great. And so I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and your listenership. I encourage everybody to go to the website, rebuildthedream.com, sign up. We're sticking up for ordinary Americans when they're getting ripped off by these banks in terms of their home mortgages being ripped off by excessive interest rates on student loans. And we think that what we have to say is resonant with ordinary folks on both sides of the political aisle. And we believe that in time, we can rebuild the American dream.
And we all hope that in many ways what you're talking about, Van, that you're right about and can happen. And as we let you go, so I know you got to run, one last thought. I mean, just as how, I mean, I the part you're about the contract for America, is that what you called it, correct?
Contract for the American.
For the American. Yeah. And those points were very powerful points. And I think that it's important what the Progressive Caucus is doing. But how do you see that? I'm curious, really, just analytically, as somebody who's been in this and watched it and observed it, how you think that's going to play itself out, especially in terms of this paradigm that you gave to us in the book. How do you think it's going to play itself out in November and then come after that?
Well, I mean, the election is impossible to tell. I mean, we just have never had an election where the corporations are running the election. And so that throws everything into a little bit of a question mark. It means that we need to step up more. People say, well, I'm not going to work as hard for Obama as I did the last time. I said, well, no, you shouldn't work as hard as you did the last time. You should work twice as hard, because it's clear the opposition is going to fight him twice as hard. And you want to pick in November who you want to have in the White House to push and fight with in December. It's not you're going to elect somebody who's going to do all your work for you. But you know, and I know, that if you put a Tea Party puppet in there as president, you can have 20 million people in the street marching, and there's nothing going to change. And so it's having that two-punch combination. The fact of these corporations with super PACs and Citizens United opening up the floodgates, that is a very crazy wild card. It is hard to know what it would mean for $1 billion to get spent in one swing state. I just don't know what that means. I can't figure that out. I mean, will that happen? Will it not happen? Can we punish the corporations who are doing it so they're afraid to do it? There's a whole series of fights that have to be sorted through. But the first step has to be absolute clarity about what this fight is about and a refusal to compromise on principle before we even get to the fight. Unfortunately, people have adopted this false view that D.C. is crippled by too much partisanship.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. There is too much right-wing extremism. There's one side of the aisle that's too partisan. But I would argue at a certain point, the Democrats became not partisan enough because we started just compromising and showed weakness and got bad results sometimes. And so sometimes in order to have bipartisanship, you have to first have some partisanship. You have to know what you stand for.
Right.
You have to make your case to the American people. And the case you make can't just be a case about bipartisanship. No, to have bipartisanship, you have to have two parties. And right now we have one extreme right-wing party and another party chasing after it, trying to make bad deals. And so the first thing that has to happen, we have to stand up for what we believe in. We have to stand up for what our grandparents and our parents achieved in this country. We have to stand up for the middle class. The greatest invention in the history of the world, as far as I'm concerned, is the American middle class. We never had a mass middle class before in human history. And we not only did we build that middle class, we built on-ramps and entry points for people of all color, for women. Not perfect. Some of those on-ramps are falling down. But we've got to honor the hard-won achievement through strikes, through civil disobedience, through voting, through arguing of our grandparents and our parents and our great-grandparents, and not let those institutions that made America great, from environmental protection to consumer protection, civil rights, labor movement, public education, investment in resource in R&D and science, and making college accessible to almost everybody, We can't let those things be taken away from us without a fight by people who call themselves patriots but are happy to hand the government over to global corporations.
Van Jones, I'll leave you with this thought and let you run. That one of the things I read about the other day in terms of what you just said in terms of our nation being split and this kind of false notion of bipartisanship, that there's not been a split in the U.S. Congress this deep since Reconstruction. And to me, historically, in terms of our present, where we are now, that says a lot.
I'll leave it at that. Well said. I appreciate the chance to talk to you. I hope you'll have me back at some point.
We will, Sue. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Van Jones.
Thank you.
Thank you. Van Jones' book, Rebuild the Dream, and you can go to rebuildthedream.com, get involved, and read the book. Van, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today is the 100th birthday of Studs Terkel, who just died a few years ago. I interviewed him five times over the years, starting in 1995. He was one of the great raconteurs and radio men and radical historians, thinkers and activists in our country's history. He wrote books like Working, People Talk About What They Do All Day and How They Feel About What They Do, American Dreams, Lost and Found, and more. And this is a part of a conversation we had in 2005, before Studs passed away. They want to share with you on this anniversary of his birth.
Ecumenism itself in every way is our salvation, whether it be directly in a matter of religion, that is, my God is a good God, but so is yours to you, and it's not the only one, mine. So ecumenism and music, of course, that's been my impulse. You described it when you said ecumenism. I hadn't thought about that. When I would play a Caruso record, these people, remember Caruso was bought by the immigrants. We talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
The immigrants who came in 1903, 1904, 1905, the Victrola was new. They bought these Caruso records, $2 a piece. That was like $50, but he gave them a certain kind of warmth and possibility. And he'd go beyond what ordinary people would go through to get that high spot. And in a way, he represented the possibilities in all people, that there's a potential in us, and he was plumbing that. As much the potential of us to behave better than we are, to think more than we do. And music is a key part of it. So from him, I'd go to Louis Armstrong and West End Blues, one of my favorites of all jazz records. He and Earl Hines at the piano, exploring the piano as though it were a trumpet. And from there, Woody Guthrie and Tom Joe doing the whole Grapes of Wrath in 6 minutes. Or it could be young Bob Dylan doing a song. So you're absolutely right, the ecumenism. And many working people have always felt that classical music is beyond them. And then one day, there's a story told of this young working man who's in the rain and he's drenched and he rushes in the hallway of something. It turns out to be the lobby of a symphony hall. And he opens the door of the auditorium slightly and he hears music and it's Mozart. And he listens, and he listens, and he feels fantastic. And suddenly realizes Mozart wrote for him. And of course he's good enough for that. So that's part of what we're talking about.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by Urbanite Magazine's new e-zines. You can get your weekly fix of arts and culture, food and drink, home and design, style and shopping, and green and sustainable topics. Updated information can be delivered to your inbox. Registration is available at UrbaniteBaltimore.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at SteinerShow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.